Choices have implications. Choices also reveal a person's heart. And this is certainly the case in the story of Jacob as it unfolds for us in the book of Genesis. Jacob reached the high point with his encounter with the angel of the Lord in Peniel when he fought with that mysterious man through the hours of the night and clung to him for a blessing. It was one of the great events in the life of Jacob, demonstrated his determination to know God and to experience God's blessing in his life. From that point, as we already saw last time, we see a kind of a downgrade in Jacob's life. We've already seen hints of his heart. We've observed the fear that he had of his brother Esau, a reasonable fear, considering the previous events of their lives entwined in the youth and vigour of their lives, the threats that were then made as a result of the deceit and lies that were evident in Jacob's life. Oh yes, reasonable fears, but nevertheless, he's met with God. He's received promises from God. He's observed the blessing of God. He should not really have been so fearful of Esau. We also have observed that having learned a lesson in being on the receiving end of a deceitful and dishonest character, things seem to have been improving with Jacob. And yet, he resorted again to deceit. As his brother left him, he left him with the promise that he would join him. He would make his way down to Seir at his own pace, and there Jacob would again join Esau. But he had no intention of doing any such thing. As soon as his brother departed, Jacob went in a different direction entirely. Oh yes, Jacob made some choices that revealed something of his heart. He wasn't perfectly loyal to God. He wasn't in a relationship of absolute and total commitment to God and trust in God. The old Jacob was still there. And he settled then in a place called Shechem. There he built an altar and called it El Elohi Israel, God, the God of Israel. He would worship God there. He would gather his family around that altar and offer sacrifices there in El Elohi Israel. Upon that plot of land that he had purchased, there where he had settled in Shechem. But why Shechem? Why did he purchase that plot of land? Why did he settle there? He's a day's journey from Bethel, that place of blessing, that place of promise, that place where he had encountered God. Why not travel that extra day? Why settle here? Because his heart is not right with God. Because he is not totally loyal to God. Because the old Jacob is still there. And the old Jacob gains the upper hand here. The old Jacob sees the land of Shechem, sees the prosperity of the valley, sees how good it is this place to renew his stocks of sheep and goats and cattle. He's been impoverished by the generosity of the gift he has given to Esau in order to make peace with his offended brother. And now he must restock, retrench, as it were. And so Shechem is the place, a place of prosperity. We have echoes here of an earlier choice. A choice of a distant relative who, on eyeing the Jordan Valley, had taken as his choice the area around Sodom and Gomorrah, a prosperous plain. We have echoes here of Lot and what motivated him in his choices. And here we see it in the life of Jacob, the life of a man who had grown used to a level of prosperity that he wanted to have renewed. But his choice would have implications for his whole family, implications for the community, implications for the honour of God. And as we consider this chapter 34 of Genesis, a sad tale that we would perhaps much rather skip over and move from verse 20 of chapter 33 to verse 1 of chapter 35 and not have to consider it. What I want to do is just to think about the three groups or individuals that we encounter in this chapter. The girl, first of all. The chapter begins with her. Now, Dinah, the daughter of Leah, whom she had borne to Jacob, went out to see the women of the land. Dinah, as far as we know, at least at this point, the only daughter of Jacob. Leah bore her after a string of sons, and she then is the only daughter in a house full of boys. It would appear that by this time some years have passed. This land that Jacob had bought with the 100 pieces of money had bought him a parcel of land in which to settle. Yes, he pitched a tent there, but going from a nomad, he has become very much semi-nomadic. Indeed, he has settled here. He's putting down roots here, and here his children are growing up. And here his daughter is growing up and sees the people of the city and wants to find out about them. She's fascinated by them. She's grown up in this religious home in which sacrifice is made on the altar at El Elohi Israel. But what of these other women? What of her peers in the city nearby? They intrigue her, and off she goes to see them. She's fascinated by the world. She wants to be like the other girls. And in doing so, she puts herself in a position of vulnerability. Shechem, the son of Hamor the Hivite, the prince of the land, saw her and seized her and lay with her and humiliated her. Was she asking for trouble? By going off with the women of the land, by entering into that city without a chaperone? To some degree, we would have to say, well, she certainly opens herself up to trouble. Her choices are not helping her. And she becomes a victim. She is, after all, it would seem to be a beautiful woman, she has a good heritage. Her grandmother was a beautiful woman, so that her grandfather was afraid for her, afraid for his own life on account of her. Her great-grandmother had been a beautiful woman too. No doubt she has inherited that beauty herself. She's the daughter also of an incredibly wealthy man. A nomad, yes. A man who lives in tents, yes. But a man with flocks and herds and camels. And then the prince, the son of the prince of the land, sees her, is attracted by her, and seizes her, takes her. This leads me to consider the guys in this story. These Canaanite guys. Shechem, particularly. Shechem saw this beautiful girl. He took her, seized her. There's the idea of force here. She's not a willing participant in this story. She's the victim, certainly. He lay with her and humiliated her. He raped her. He has been taken by her beauty. Even after he has raped her, he doesn't cast her off. But he wants her. He wants her to be his wife. He speaks to his father and says, "Get me this girl for my wife." He holds on to her and speaks tenderly to her. All through the rest of this chapter, we need to remember that she is either willingly or unwillingly in his house. She's not sent back to her father while negotiations take place. She's there with Shechem all along. And Shechem wants her. He takes her. He has no regard for formalities until he has humiliated her. And then, even then, he's unconcerned about the morality of the situation. He shows absolutely no remorse for what he has done. He even is so bold as to say to her father and brothers, "If I have found favour in your sight." "Oh yes, of course you found favour in our sight. You've taken our sister, our daughter, and raped her. Of course you found favour in our sight." But that's the kind of attitude he has. These are the kinds of people they're dealing with. This is the kind of world that they have settled in. His father too shows no concern for what his son has done. He's only interested in the negotiations. And in that, he has his own agenda. He saw profit in the match and drew the entire city along with him into this covenant, this commitment, this deal that he makes. Of course, he's not entirely honest with Jacob and Jacob's sons. He presents them with the suggestion that they will have the freedom of the land, that it will be theirs, that they will dwell together as equals. He is, in a sense, offering them citizenship through this marriage. When he speaks to the people of the city, he doesn't mention to them that he has done a deal with Jacob and Jacob's sons. He presents it as all positive and for the profit of the city, of the men of the city. Their livestock will become our livestock. We will be enriched by this. Yes, this is the kind of world that Jacob has settled in. A world of wheeling and dealing. A world of grasping for what they want. Deceiving and being deceived, that the winner may take all. These are the guys that they are dealing with. And then the third party in this play that is being acted out before us are the guardians. There's Jacob, of course. Dinah is his daughter. And Jacob in this story seems to be portrayed as a weak coward. He himself is more concerned about his position in the community and his peace with his neighbours than he is with his daughter's honour. There may be a certain amount of politicking going on here when he pauses after hearing the news and doesn't respond immediately. He waits for his sons to come. But what is remarkable is the attitude in which he waits. There is absolutely no suggestion here that Jacob is angered, disquieted in any way by these events that have played out. I mean, you contrast this with the well-known story that we know that is coming up later on in a couple of chapters. The story of Joseph. Well, what happens when he hears that Joseph has been taken? It seems that he's been killed by a wild animal. The coat of many colours that had been given is covered in blood. And what does Jacob do? Well, that's a shame. Such a great son. Oh, he's full of woe. His life comes crashing down. Nothing will make him happy. Nothing will give him joy from then on. For years and years and years and years. And we don't even get a hint of that in this story, of his only daughter being raped by one of his neighbours. It's amazing, really. Furthermore, where's his trust in God in all of this? He's concerned about the way that he should react in order that the inhabitants of the land shouldn't take offence. He says to two of his sons who do take some action, "You've brought trouble on me by making me stink to the inhabitants of the land, these Canaanites and Perizzites. If they attack me, I shall be destroyed." Will the God who has been with him over 20 years in Paddan Aram turn his back on him now? Will the God who has brought him safely back to this land of promise desert him now? Will the God to whom he clung and from whom he received a blessing make him fodder for his enemies now? Jacob is all caught up in himself, you see. This fear of Esau that we observed in the last chapter, and the deceitfulness by which he separated from his brother on that occasion, is driving him further and further and further away from God. God never once appears in this chapter. From verse 1 through verse 31. He's there at the end of chapter 33. And he's there at the very first word of the very first verse of chapter 35. But in chapter 34, God is not in Jacob's life. Jacob is all caught up in himself. But Jacob is not Dinah's only guardian. Her brothers, Jacob's sons, are her guardians too. It would almost seem as though Jacob, for some reason or another, has handed over her guardianship to them. He certainly seems to do so in this chapter. And they react as we would have expected Jacob to react. As soon as they hear the news, they respond. As soon as they hear the news, they leave their flocks, they come running back to Jacob. And they are filled with anger. They are indignant because of this outrageous thing that has been done. The language that is used by Moses here is strong language. It reflects the language that describes God's response to the wickedness in the world through which the flood came. And they were ready to act. And they did so immediately. It seems that they have been thinking about their response on their way from the fields to meet with Jacob. They have a plan hatched already before Hamor or Shechem come and rendezvous with them. They already have decided what they're going to do. And so as Hamor and Shechem present to Jacob and his sons their plan, the sons of Jacob respond with their own plan, but they are not honest. They are chips off the old block, as the proverb says. Like father, like son, they speak deceitfully. We can't do this. We can't give you our sister. You're not circumcised. If you agree to this plan, you become circumcised like us, then we will agree to your offer. We will give our daughters to be married. We will take of your daughters. We will become one people. We will dwell together in the land as equals. But if you don't do this, then we will take our daughter. The language is the same as that of Shechem taking her. That is the idea of force here. We will come, we will take our daughter, and we will be gone. We will make war against you. The agreement is entered into. A covenant is made. Hamor and Shechem agree to this proposal by the brothers of Dinah, and they encourage the whole of the city to agree to it also. And as they experience the pain and the incapacitation of this operation, two of the sons of Jacob, two full brothers of Dinah, come and attack them when they're unable to defend themselves. And they kill all the men of the city. And the other brothers come along after them and they pillage the city. They take everything of value. And so the promise that Hamor had made to his citizens, that they would be enriched through this treaty of peace, actually turns against them, and it is the sons of Jacob who are enriched. But they, in taking this vengeance, overreact to the circumstances. They do not consult God in the least. Oh well, there's an altar there. El Elohi Israel is there. God, the God of Israel, is apparently worshipped on this patch of land that Jacob has bought. But the sons of Jacob don't consult him. They don't ask God what they should do. Furthermore, they break an agreement that they have entered into, a solemn promise that they have made. They do it all deceitfully, under the guise of peace. These men are at peace with us, when in reality they were hatching a plan to annihilate the men of the city and take all the possessions for themselves as a kind of a fine because of the rape of their sister. The girl, the guys, the guardians. None of them really come off looking too good in this story, do they? Why is that? Well, as I say, it's because God is absent from this chapter. God is not there. You see, they all live for themselves in this chapter, not for God. Dinah lives for herself. She's intrigued by the women of the land. She's fascinated by the world. She wants to taste it, touch it, experience it for herself. She goes away from the protection of El Elohi Israel. The guys, well, we would recognize the fact that they're not going to acknowledge God in all of this. Though one would have anticipated that given that Jacob has lived there for at least some years, they would have some idea of El Elohi Israel, God, the God of Israel. What kind of witness has Jacob been presenting in this land? Well, they live for themselves. They're out to be enriched. They'll take what they want. And the guardians, the people who had responsibility, why did Jacob let Dinah go? Why did the sons respond in this way? Why did their father not have any say in the matter or hinder them? It would seem that he knew nothing of the plan, given his response in verse 30. But it seemed that he was powerless to do anything anyway, even if he had known the plan. They're acting the way he had acted. He had shown a lack of trust in God. He had deceitfully departed from Esau with lies concerning his destination, rather than acknowledging the will of God for his life, that he return not with Esau to Seir, but with God to Bethel. The sons are certainly and rightly concerned for the reputation of their sister, who has been treated like a prostitute. But they're not concerned for the glory of God or the honour of his name in the land. You see, they're each out for themselves. They're each doing things their own way. They're each wanting their own results from all of this. And that's the problem, because for all of them, God doesn't seem to be in the picture at all. Where is he? By whose values are they living, each one of these? Jacob has led the way, you see, in laying up for himself treasures in the world. Treasures in Shechem, a parcel of land. Increasing prosperity as his livestock flourishes there. And the question that we must ask as we consider this sad story is, well, where is our focus? Where is our treasure? What motivates us in the choices that we make? You see, this would be a great warning to the children of Israel for whom Moses is writing. They're on the verge of entering into the promised land. A land full of enemies. A land full of people who will want to make treaties with them. Treaties of peace. What will they do? Will they honour God by obeying him? Or will they compromise for peace and earthly prosperity? But what values do we live? What motivates us? Do we want to live comfortably in this world, at peace with all around us, or does God come first? Are our choices made on the basis of God's word and God's promises, or upon our own understanding of a situation and our own dreams for peace and prosperity? God doesn't remain out of this picture for long. And indeed, God is at work in all of this. These tragic events that unfold here, God uses to wake Jacob up to his call. We'll see next time that God speaks to Jacob and calls him to Bethel. Calls to him out of this place of settledness. Perhaps, you see, he would not have responded to the call had such tragic events not unfolded in his life. Had the treasures not been ripped away from him, perhaps he would have forgotten the voice of God and not recognized it when it came to him. Choices have implications. They had implications in Jacob's life. But the amazing, astonishing mercy of God overrules our poor choices, doesn't eliminate the sad consequences, but he overrules them to bring us back into his way. Sometimes we have to learn lessons the hard way. But let us remember from this story, we don't need to learn lessons the hard way if we will make the right choices in the first place. If we will put God first in the first place. If we will have as our focus his glory, his honour in the first place.